Hello and welcome to At the Letters for March 24th, 2025. Opening day is just a couple days away here as we approach the beginning of a new season for the Blue Jays, a new season for At the Letters, although really we've been at this now for 6 or 7 weeks, as have the Blue Jays in spring training, but it's now time to get to the games that count. So I am joined by Arden Zwelling as usual on this edition of At the Letters, presented by MLB The Show 25, and this episode is produced by Christian Ryan, so thank you to Christian as well for putting it all together. Arden, we have a lot to get to this episode here. We know the roster. Alejandro Kirk has been extended. There is still more Vlad Jr. talk to get to, but first of all, how are you doing? What's your mindset here as opening day approaches just a couple days away?
Frankly, my mindset is more real life because I'm going home today. So yeah. I'm kind of thinking about that and thinking about if there's like eggs in the fridge. But I don't know that anybody really cares about that. But that's where my mindset is right now.
That makes so much sense. I mean, you've been down there for a long time. When it comes to this season, when it comes to, you know, what you're kind of looking forward to or where your head's at with respect to the Blue Jays and just like the, you know, the impending 162 games that are coming our way, what are you thinking about that?
Well, I'm thinking about Kevin Smith, who retired today, if you missed that. And I'm thinking about him because I remember it would have been like 2018 that he got up to AA and had this incredible season and like hit a bunch of homers. And everybody with the Jays was talking about, the swing decisions are so good. And he's just so mature. Like, he has such a poised approach and he really thinks the game. He's a real analytical mind. And, you know, this is a guy who could really take some strides. We're going to send him to the Fall League. And we feel like developmentally, he's, somebody who's going to be a real priority for us. And here we are just 7 years later or so, and he's retiring at the age of 28. So not to undercut the young career of one Alan Rodon, but I do think that, the assumption that he's just going to hit the ground running in the majors is often a fraught one. Even Jackson Holliday got to the majors and struck out in like 200% of his plate appearances. So wishing him nothing but the best, but open to a wide variety of outcomes as he starts his big league career.
Yeah, and it might be a relatively short chance in the majors. We'll see how things play out as Dalton Varsho tries to return. Hopefully for the Blue Jays, that's not too long of an absence for Varsho. We'll see what that means for Rodon. For me, as the season gets started here, like, I am intrigued to see, of course, you know, how the Blue Jays can do, how Max Scherzer can perform. Watching guys like Rodon is going to be super fun. And I think, too, like, every season, there are a few players who kind of step into that inner circle of star major leaguers, and probably not going to happen on the Blue Jays this year. Not ruling anything out, but probably not. But you had a Jackson Churio and a Jackson Merrill and a Paul Skeens stepping up to become like impact major league centerpiece franchise type players. And that will happen again this year around the major leagues. And I always just, I'm so interested to see, is that a Jackson Jobe? Is that, an Andrew Painter? Is that a Roky Sasaki? Like, who are those guys who take that step forward? Christian Campbell and Roman Anthony on the Red Sox. There's so many of these young players who have that chance, and we're going to get some answers to that. So that's always interesting. And then also just the fact that the results count, like the stakes are there, is kind of refreshing because, I mean, I don't have to tell you this of pretty much anyone. You've probably watched more spring training than all but a very short list of people this year. But, at a certain point, the spring training games are kind of like, yeah, like let's get this over with. Let's get to games that actually count for something.
You're not thinking about Kevin Smith, is what you're saying.
That is accurate. I would say that he has not crossed my mind in a year plus.
Are you thinking about Joshua Palacios or Anthony Alford, Ty Tice, Patrick Murphy? You think about any of those guys?
I don't think I ever thought about Ty Tice. Anthony Alford, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's an interesting comp as well. I mean, these are good reminders.
Right, guys who impressed in spring training and who we were talking a big game about going into the year. And then all of a sudden, something changed when the regular season starts. And that's to your point, because spring training baseball, like, it's fake baseball. It's not real baseball. You've got a guy on the mound who's working on something and a guy in the box is working on something. So the guy who's throwing the pitches might be thinking, I got to throw like 10 changeups today because that's what I've been working on and that's my quota. So I don't care that I'm right on right to a guy who loves the ball down and in. I'm going to throw him that change up that's going to move to the arm side down and into him. And the guy who's in the box might be thinking, I want to work on being behind in the count. And I don't like, I'm going to take this pitch no matter what's thrown. So he's going to get his right on right change up that is like just running perfectly into his happy zone. And he's going to take it for a called strike because he's determined to get to 0-1. So it's nice to kind of remove all of those variables and all of those elements that lead to spring training results really meaning nothing and get in down to actual competition, actual baseball games where there's actual scouting reports and thorough preparation and plans that are tailored to the opposing pitcher or opposing lineup and strategy being deployed via the bench as well, whether it's in runs or whether it's, hey, take a pitch here, or whether it's let's be aggressive against this guy. Like, just happy to get to, you know, baseball being played as baseball, not baseball being played as like two separate science labs that are, you know, just conducting experiments simultaneously.
Yeah, that's actually a good way to put it. It's like they're just doing these things beside each other, but it doesn't. And this is where, I mean, I know the Blue Jays had the best record in the Grapefruit League, and it truly doesn't matter, I hate to say it. I mean, it's a fun little novelty. But if they had the worst record in the Grapefruit League, I wouldn't be sitting here saying it was a problem. So the games truly don't matter, and now they do, which is great. Because honestly, man, it's been a while since Blue Jays baseball games mattered, which is... like, I don't know, like May of last year, June. They faced the Guardians. I think it went downhill. So I don't know, June of 2024, it's like 9 months ago now. Like, it's going to be nice to have games that actually count for something.
Are you thinking about Vinny Capra?
Vinny? No, I am definitely not. You seem to have them all ready here. Who are some of these other guys who just made like late spring rosters?
Well, do you know who led spring training in home runs this year? Vinny Capra. For baseball, for MLB, my friend. Vinny Capra of the Milwaukee Brewers hit 6 bombs this spring, tied for the lead with other Blue Jays notables such as Matt Chapman and Ryan Mountcastle and Cal Raleigh. So,
wow.
Raleigh and Mountcastle only had 5, my mistake. So Capra, better than Mountcastle and Raleigh, confirmed.
Couple Blue Jays nemeses right there. Those guys have hit the team very hard. Since we last spoke, we actually have an answer on what the roster looks like. And you've already alluded to one of the big surprises on this team, which is Alan Rodon. He is a Blue Jay. He's going to break camp with this ball club. Let's start there. What do you make of this decision and what it means for Rodon and the team?
Are you thinking about Ryan Noda? Led spring training and walks. I'll stop. But he led spring training and walks this year, by the way.
Yeah, another great eye for the prospect. Plate. Great idea for the strike zone. You know, if you want like a quad A first baseman, future, I would say KBO legend, Ryan Noda.
That's actually a perfect place to put him. He will play KBO someday, for sure. He is following like the Eric Thames trajectory. He's going to go to KBO and he's going to rake and he's going to come back and have like one or two kind of big years with like some team that just needs cheap pop, like the Athletics, the Angels or something.
I don't know about that. You're a little more Ryan Noda optimistic than me. I think his career might end in the KBO.
Anyway, you asked a relevant question. I'll give you a relevant answer. I think that it came down to Rodon v. Barger for that final spot. Like the Blue Jays, they take Straw and Lucas because they got to cover off center field. And I think that's going to run as like somewhat of a platoon situation in center, although it'll depend on who's on the mound, fly ball pitcher versus ground ball pitcher. It'll probably depend on size of the outfield as well. And I do think Alan Rodon will get into center like every now and then, maybe once a week, but probably not at like Fenway Park, probably more so at home. But I think that once center was covered off for, it was Rodon or Barger. And these are two guys who both, like, they had the two best camps, I think, of anybody in spring. Like, these are two guys who just barreled everything. You know, the only player in camp who had a higher OPS than Barger was Roden. You know, if you just sort any kind of statistical category, like, and put aside like results like xWOBA, you know, X slug, exit velocity, like a lot of the process stuff, pitches per plate, appearance, chase rate, these two guys were near the top. So I don't think the Blue Jays could have gone wrong in either direction. I think that ultimately it came down to a belief that Roden will be just a steadier, more consistent producer, whereas like maybe Barger has a higher ceiling. And Barger, like, if you you know, kind of think of his like kind of moving line chart, he might have a higher high, but he might also have a lower low, whereas Roden's high won't be as high, but his lows won't be as low. Like, he'll just be kind of a steadier, straighter line, whereas Barger is going to go like way up and down, like a heartbeat. So I think that was part of it. And I think also just like positionally, you know, that you can throw Roden in center if you need to. You obviously can't do that with Barger. So Roden gives you a bit more flexibility there. So I think that's really what it came down to.
Yeah. I think, you know, that's kind of the nature of these players who have really good control of the strike zone as a hitter, is you're going to just see more of an even performance for them more times than not. Same reason that Alejandro Kirk has value as a hitter. He's just not striking out that much. We'll get to him later, of course. But for Roden, he's had incredible command of the strike zone for his entire pro career, his entire college career. It's one of his great attributes as a hitter. So that'll help the Blue Jays. I like this call a lot. I think, you know, we touched on it last week, but I think that, you know, developmentally, of course, you don't want someone to stagnate, but I think there's so much room for him to develop as a player in the major leagues when he's being challenged by the best pitching that there is, when he's being surrounded by players who, you know, prepare in a really thoughtful way, and he can kind of learn from those guys and pick up a lot from really good coaches as well. So, you know, I'm sure that the Blue Jays have made him no promises about, you know, you're going to be up here all year. In fact, it's likely that when Varsho comes up, Roden might be the first guy down. We'll see. Maybe Nathan Lucas, maybe Miles Straw. Some of that will depend on performance, but I like this call, and I think that it's a good thing for Roden. I think it's a good thing for the team to get a little bit more offense. You still have Miles Straw on the roster for some defense and for some base running, and so I think that this configuration makes sense, and if Barger goes to AAA and absolutely performs well, he'll find his way back up here.
Yeah, and Roden's going to play. Like, if the Jays play six games in a week, I think Roden could start four of them. Yeah, unless you've got this weird week where you're like facing four of six lefty starters or something like that. But like, I think that you'll see him start four of those games, and look, so the teams are going to, you know, match up with him late with a tough lefty reliever, and then he's just going to get pinch hit for. That's the reality of there. But like, he's going to be starting. He could hit in the top half of the order. Bo Bichette's going to be the leadoff hitter to begin the season. But like, if Roden hits the ground running and he keeps doing what he's been doing in spring training, there's a non-zero chance that he's leading off for this team like 3 weeks from now.
Yeah,
like that's very realistic. And the Blue Jays coaching staff, like, they are not going to be uber cautious with him. Like, if he's hitting, he's producing. If he's showing an approach, a plan at the plate, and he's staying within himself and slowing things down, yeah, they'll lead him off, no problem. Like, it's funny. I heard a story. The like kind of what sealed Roden's fate was Saturday in Fort Myers, the Scherzer game. Thanks, Max. We all drove, you know, 2.5 hours down there to see you, because, you know, Scherzer just had to pitch on the road in Fort Myers, second last day of spring training. Well, that meant I get to go see Alan Roden as well. And like, there were some Blue Jays coaches who didn't make that trip. They stayed back and they were kind of following along with it. And they were very curious to see how Roden performed, because he'd only had like one AB over his last 4 days, just because of, you know, the way lineups had worked out. And it was just kind of how it shook out. So he'd been out of competition for a little bit, and the coaching staff was just keen to see how he did, right? Because it's not the easiest thing to go from the rhythm of everyday plate appearances to not facing live pitching for 4 days. And Roden steps in for his first plate appearance with two out and a runner on second. He's facing Scott Blewett, who was a big leaguer last year. And first pitch, Roden shoots like a 96 mile per hour exit velo line drive the opposite way, drives in the run. And then his next time up, his second plate appearance, I forget who he was facing, but he was like a really hard thrower, and he flips up like first pitch breaking ball for a strike, just lands it on the plate. Like the, it's perfect for the pitcher, right? You get count leverage. The hitter knows you've got 98 and you just stole a first pitch strike with a breaking ball. That's huge. What does Rodon do? He spits on like three borderline pitches that are just off, that are called balls. Now he has count leverage. It's 3-1 and he smacks a 3-1 like 98 mile per hour single into right at 103 off the bat. And like those two plate appearances, those two approaches, those two processes, that's really what sealed Rodon's spot on this roster after he'd been off for a few days.
Alan Rodon hits the first pitch he sees, and it gets past Eli White into right center. Springer scores, and Alan Rodon keeps producing. He's got an RBI single.
Yeah, that's an impressive approach. And one last point on Rodon from me here is just that, you know, we're talking about him. Of course, he's like, he's doing all these things well, and he has a lot of promise. And, you know, this is a guy who has hit. He's an intriguing prospect. Like, legitimately, he could be someone who contributes to the Blue Jays for a few years here. Like, this is a really interesting player and a really interesting rookie. And then you look at the year he was born, 1999. That's the same year that Vlad Jr. was born. So it just, to me, it kind of underscores, like, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., he is as young as some promising rookies in this sport on this team. And we've had this discussion so many times, so many variations of this over the years, but it's worth repeating once again. This is just how young Vlad Jr. is. Alan Rodon and him, they would have been in the same grade growing up. And here they are, Vladdy, the established veteran, Alan Rodon just, you know, making the team here as an exciting rookie. And we'll see how that combination plays out. But I just think it's an interesting contrast.
I suppose the flip side of that is that's how old these Blue Jays prospects are. Because right, when you look at it, it's not just Rodon. Like we talk about, oh, Nathan Lucas made the team. Like Nathan Lucas is going to turn 31 this year. You know, yeah. Will Wagner made the team. He's going to be 27 this year. Davis Schneider is 26. Ernie Clement's 29. Like Miles Straw made the team. He's 30. Like the Blue Jays have some old prospects. They aren't exactly calling up like the Tatises or the Bichettes and Vlads from their day, or the Merrills or what have you. Kumar Rockers, who are in their early 20s and getting to the big leagues quick. Their prospects typically are the slow burn developmental kind, who were like fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh round picks, or they bounced around some organizations and the Jays helped them unlock something and got them to the big leagues. So, which is a credit to them. Like, that's good player development. But we are talking about two kind of different classes of quote unquote prospects here when we're comparing the Vlads and Bos to some of the prospects we've been talking about recently for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, nobody is going to mistake Alan Rodon's prospect type for the Vlad Jr. prospect type that was the subject of like countless ATL discussions and episodes when he was on his way up, let alone once he got to the major leagues. So that's for sure. Now, rounding out the position player group here, I do find it interesting that the Blue Jays took Miles Straw, and I actually kind of like this because I thought if Straw had been on the team at the expense of Rodon, I wouldn't have liked that. But if you actually have both on the team, there are clear uses for Miles Straw, and it could be pinch running for a catcher, could be pinch running for another position player who's kind of slow or banged up, and it could be late game defense where maybe you start the game with Springer in center field or even Lucas or Rodon. You're up by one run late in the game. You know, that hitter maybe just had an at-bat the previous inning. Boom, Miles Straw, defense. I like it. I think there's a clear use case for him.
Yeah, and the Blue Jays don't exactly have a high strikeout staff. Like Max Scherzer is probably the strikeout guy on the staff right now, considering Kevin Gausman's drop off in strikeouts last year. We'll see if that comes back. But like, yeah, the 41-year-old veteran mercenary is the strikeout guy. Berríos, Bassett, Francis, like the ball's in play. So you want good defense out there, certainly without Varsho. And we've all seen the way that center field defense can improve corner outfield defense. Like Varsho really helps his corner outfielders, and I think the Straw can help you do that as well. And look, your corner outfielders are Anthony Santander and George Springer, who are veteran corner outfielders, and Springer can still go get it, but I mean at a certain point he's going to be slowing down and the quick twitch isn't going to be quite there anymore. So the more you can decrease the range that those two have to cover, the better. And I'm interested to see Straw in a new environment. Like, he's one of these guys who has really taken to the new hitting staff here. I think that, you know, it's pretty evident that, you know, he wasn't loving life with the Guardians last year. He told me like 2024 was a huge mental grind for him, right? He spent four straight years as a big leaguer before he was outrighted at the end of last camp. And like, you know, he told me like that wore on him mentally. He wasn't in a great headspace for a lot of the season. And he's really appreciated just having the opportunity to kind of clear his mind. And he told me he'd like have fun playing the game again. He likes some of the fresh perspectives he's had here with the Jays. Obviously, he has to perform. The Blue Jays are, they might get to a position where if Varsho is ready to be activated and Roden's in a place where you just can't take him off this team, like, could be a difficult decision between a Straw and a Lucas at that point, honestly. So, you know, the Blue Jays could get to that point some point this year if Straw isn't hitting and if he isn't contributing. But there are things that he does well, as you mentioned, the base running and the defense. And I think there's confidence that the Blue Jays can get a bit more out of the bat this year now that Straw's in a bit of a better headspace.
Yes. David Schneider in that outfield mix as well. They actually have a lot of outfielders here, with Will Wagner kind of being their alternate to Ernie Clement at third base as needed. So yeah, that's the position player side of things. Now, the pitcher side of things, they ended up taking Richard Lovelady and Jacob Barnes on the Major League bullpen, and Ryan Yarbrough not included in that group. The Blue Jays did not select his contract. He did not make the team. This was a little surprising to some people. Certainly, if Ryan Yarbrough was surprised, I wouldn't fault him, because it seemed as though he had been given, not promises, but, you know, pretty strong indications that he had a good shot to make this team. Didn't end up happening. I got some thoughts on this, but what did you make of Ryan Yarbrough not making the team, and what that says about this pitching staff as a whole?
Yeah, I think Ryan's belief was that he was here to kind of work on his stuff and like build up workload and get up to speed. Not so much, hey, you're competing for a roster spot every single time out. Yeah, I think he definitely would have been surprised. But he's landed on his feet very quickly. He's a New York Yankee now, so it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. You know, ultimately, I think the Blue Jays just figured there was some redundancy there with Yarbrough and Yariel, right? Like, once Scherzer's thumb was good to go, I don't think the Blue Jays wanted to have two long guys in their bullpen like this early in the season, when you're being, you know, just a little more cautious with like relievers on back to backs. Certainly not going like three days in a row early in the season. I think the Blue Jays just want as many kind of short stint options out there as possible, and they just weren't sure where the fit was going to be with Yarbrough. They definitely wanted to take two lefties, that's for sure. So that's why you get Lovelady in there. And then with Barnes, like, the Blue Jays just like his experience. They like his steadiness. He's obviously not the guy you're going to be giving the ball to when it's like the eighth inning and you're up by one. But he is like a capable veteran reliever who's like shown some decent stuff this spring, like still throws the ball hard. Lovely as well, has kind of a sneaky fastball and a really good slider. And you look at what he did with the Rays last year. Some things were really working for him, and he feels like he ironed out some stuff in his delivery coming back from Tommy John that had kind of bled in there. He felt like he'd lost some crossfire, some deception. And he actually went to driveline over the winter and really worked on some of that stuff to get that back. So I do think that, you know, it's the end of your bullpen, and these are names that are going to change out 100 times this season, and the Blue Jays will probably end up using like 30 relievers this year in the end. So, you know, I'm not really surprised by anything that happens at the end of a bullpen, because if I had told you last spring that there would be like a Jose Quas era, I'm just not sure that you would have believed me.
Yes. We don't have any over-unders this year on At the Letters, but if I was feeling mean and I was doing over-unders this year, I might say over under 9.5 days on the roster for Richard Lovelady or Jacob Barnes. And, you know, you could take the over, that'd be reasonable. But point being, these guys are not necessarily here for the long haul. At the same time, anything could happen. Maybe they will be, you know. Good luck to them as they try to explore, as they try to find themselves here in the Toronto Blue Jays bullpen. But as for Yarbrough, I actually would have taken him. I think that the length would help, and I think it would be a asset for a major league team. Obviously, the Yankees agree with that, and the Blue Jays to a degree agree with that, because they had him last year and brought him back into camp this year. But at the same time, I can't sit here and be all that shocked by it, just because the market kind of told us what they think about Ryan Yarbrough. And all offseason, I mean, presumably if a team was offering him $3 million on a major league deal, he would have taken it. He wouldn't have been taking a minor league deal from the Blue Jays. So this is a pitcher who does a lot of things really well, and he has gotten results in the major leagues as recently as last year when he had a 3.19 ERA in 100 innings. But he has first percentile fastball velocity. Another way of saying he throws as slow as anyone in the major leagues. He is the slowest pitcher essentially in the major leagues when it comes to fastball velo. So teams just don't value that. The market is telling us that they don't value pitchers who are soft tossers. And I think that that's a, you know, there's room to, you know, play on that and find some value there if nobody else is valuing it. And that's why I would have taken him, because again, 3.19 ERA in 100 innings last year, this guy isn't fluking his way to these results. He does some things well when it comes to location and keeping hitters off balance, all those things that we saw last year. But, you know, I can't sit here and say I'm shocked, because the industry as a whole loves velocity. They will spend on velocity. They will spend on stuff. And if someone's out here throwing 86, they're just not going to see that same type of motivation from the buyers in this league.
Well, on the other side, not to bring like the ugly business aspect of it into this, but Ryan Yarbrough would have made $2 million if his contract was selected. And considering that roster spot could be somewhat fluid and fungible towards the end of the Blue Jays bullpen, and they could even just find themselves in a situation where they have no one else to kind of move off the roster because they need a pitcher who can like come in and throw innings for them to cover because they're on the long road trip and they just had a rain out and doubleheader or what have you, and it just has to be Yarbrough who's moved off, even though maybe you don't want to do it, it's your only choice. That could have been, like, that's just not how I'm probably deploying those $2 million on that roster spot, particularly when I'm already beyond the second luxury tax threshold. So I'm already paying like a significant tax on those $2 million. And I might want to preserve some flexibility in case, like at last year's trade deadline, if things go pear-shaped and I'm making a bunch of trades, so that I have the flexibility to move back under the two luxury tax thresholds that I'm already above to try to reset my tax penalty, not lose a draft pick, not have to deal with any of that kind of stuff, and have some more flexibility for next year to raise payroll back up again without excess penalties. So that is like one kind of cold-hearted, bloodless sort of business aspect of it here. If you can get them to sign an advance consent, which basically means that a player on a minor league deal, their major league salary like isn't locked in until 45 days into the season, and within those first 45 days, if you end up moving them off the roster, DFAing them, releasing them, what have you, then you just pay them the prorated portion of the $2 million. If I could have done that with Yarbrough, I probably would have taken him. I don't know if that was offered to him. I don't know if he would have accepted it. I have no idea, but it is a consideration here, I think, when you're talking about a club that's running a payroll like the Blue Jays are and who are in a bit of a roster situation like they are right now.
Yes, and that is not unique to the Blue Jays. These decisions happen in all, pretty much all 30 organizations. You know, teams are balancing this. Who's out of options? Who's signed an advance consent? Who's got, you know, more roster flexibility than the others, along with the performance side? So it is kind of cold-hearted. It's not the most fun or like electric topic to discuss here on the brink of opening day necessarily. So I think your analysis is spot on. I'll leave it there. Before we move on to Alejandro Kirk and Vlad Guerrero Jr., do you have any further thoughts on this roster and how it came together in Dunedin this past weekend?
My only thought is that the starting pitching depth right now looks awfully thin, and I'm sure the Blue Jays will be prowling the waiver wire as camps end here and players end up there and players in other camps don't make teams and opt out and end up DFA'd and what have you, because beyond the five in the Blue Jays rotation, Jake Bloss is the only other healthy starter on the 40-man currently. Eric Lauer is not on the 40-man. Adam Macko is hurt. Adam Kloffenstein is hurt. And then you're into Andrew Bash, CJ Van Eyck territory awfully quickly. So it's a very real concern, I think, the Blue Jays starting pitching depth, especially considering the age of their starters and the fact that Max Scherzer's thumb is something that's going to have to be managed throughout the season.
Yeah, it's the number one concern with this team. It's the number one question around this team. Later this week at sportsnet.ca, we are going to have roundtable predictions for a lot of things. So keep your eyes open for it. Awards, some questions around Major League Baseball, some questions around the Toronto Blue Jays. And one of the questions is, of course, who's going to make the playoffs? And I'll tell you right now, I do not have the Blue Jays making the playoffs this year. I am sorry to say this. I wish I had like full optimism to share with our audience right now. But I just see them kind of on the outside looking in right now because of that pitching depth. That is the biggest question to me. I like their offensive depth. I like their position player group. I think they're going to be in it, but I have them just missing because of that very reason, that beyond the starting five, it thins out pretty fast.
Two ways to look at that. If you're a listener, last year Ben had them in the playoffs. He was wrong. So it's possible that he's wrong again. But last year I didn't have them in the playoffs and I was right. And I don't have them in the playoffs again this year. So you either want me to be wrong or you want Ben to be wrong, but we cannot both. Or wait, you want us both to be wrong. You want us both to
well,
be wrong.
Hopefully our listeners want us to be right sometimes, or else they wouldn't spend their time with us. But who am I to comment on how people listen and with what motivations? But we will come back shortly and continue this discussion on At the Letters, presented by MLB The Show 25. It is now time for the decision of the week here on At the Letters, presented by MLB The Show 25. How will your journey evolve? And Arden, the Blue Jays made the decision this week to sign Alejandro Kirk to a contract extension for 5 years and $58 million. The extension will start in 2026, as he was already under contract for 2025. So this deal keeps him in Toronto as the Blue Jays' primary catcher through his age 31 season. Lots of angles to go on this one, and we'll get into a lot of them, I'm sure. But big picture, what do you make of this deal?
I think it's good for both sides. Like, I like it for them both. I think the easy way to look at it is that take out $8 million for his final arbitration year, and then just look at four free agent years for $50 million is basically what's being bought out here. So
yes,
if you say like, so that's $12.5 million a year for 4 years of free agency, that's being paid like a top five catcher in the game. You know, like that is a definitely fair for Kirk and definitely a high rate to pay for the Blue Jays. But Kirk, I think, is definitely a top five catcher currently. You know, defensively for sure. And offensively, the potential is obviously there. The results haven't always been there. But the, you know, indicators that we have so far this spring are certainly promising. And the Blue Jays obviously know more about the works that have gone on behind the scenes for Kirk to address just some of the deficiencies that have held him back in the past. So, you know, it's like the Sean Murphy extension with Atlanta, right? A little bit more AAV, a little bit less term. Kirk's younger. There's probably more questions about Kirk's ability to like withstand workload and, you know, maintain what he's doing at the plate going forward than there would be with Murphy. So I think that just with all of that context, it's honestly like a really fair deal for both the Blue Jays and for Alejandro Kirk.
Signed with the Royals.
Kirk has driven one to deep right center field. It's gone. Man, a blast to the opposite field for Alejandro Kirk, the fourth home run of the day for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, I like this deal. I think extensions like this really can benefit both sides. It's not something the Blue Jays have done much of at all under Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins. This is the third ever extension for this front office of 3+ years. You know, there's some smaller deals for like a Justin Smoak or, you know, arbitration deals for a Matt Chapman. That's kind of, you know, a little bit more administrative, crossing T's and dotting I's than it is a true extension where you're carrying forward many, many years into the future, which this deal does. And I think that first things first, Kirk is a good player. He helps you on offense. He's a better hitter than most catchers. With his command of the strike zone, knowledge of when to swing, ability to draw a walk, and he can hit some gappers. He can, you know, you don't necessarily see him putting up huge home run totals, but he can lift some over the wall, and he can definitely hit some scorchers into the gaps. So it's a better offensive profile than you get most catchers. And defensively, he's really good. We know about the framing. He's gotten to be a better thrower. He works well with his pitching staff. So there are a lot of positives there. I do think that the Murphy extension is kind of the best comp that there is. I mean, his deal is 6 years, 73. If you add in Kirk's arbitration for 2025, that gets you to 6 and 63 for the Blue Jays. So a little bit less for Kirk than Murphy. But then again, Murphy had kind of showing more offense and more power at that point, and power gets you paid in free agency a lot of the time. So I think this is a good deal for the Blue Jays. By no means is it some outrageous steal. As you said, Kirk does well for himself in this one as well. But I think it's a good move for the Jays. This is what they should be doing. They didn't have a lot of answers long-term behind the plate. There's not someone who's just coming up and forcing their way into this roster as the catcher of the future. And you need answers at that position. So Kirk can provide some. I think it's a good move.
Yeah, it's like, it's so interesting because it was just a year ago and you and I overlapped at spring for a lot of this. Like Alejandro Kirk wasn't even in camp. And there was a ton of concern over when he was going to show up. And look, he had a great reason for not being there. He was with his wife. She was having a girl. He was tending to that. But it was a process that dragged on for a while. And the Blue Jays kind of got to a point where it was like, we're going to need Kirk in camp in like the next couple days if we're going to, get him ready for the season. Like they sent Louis Hurtado down to California where Kirk and his wife were to like work him out and to kind of start getting him up to speed. And you kind of saw the results of missing a huge portion of spring training early last year because the arm strength was down, the exit velos were down, there was no power to Kirk's game. He was doing a great job of, as you said, framing and blocking balls and game calling and working with the pitchers and all that stuff. But like the measurables, it was notable how far they were down. And then you look at the difference this year coming off of a winter when Kirk got to Dunedin in like November. And so he's been here since prior to Christmas, since prior to December, working with Blue Jays staff. He's gone through an entire Wade Ball program to really maximize his arm strength and put him in a better position to start the year. You just look at the difference in the measurables this spring. Last spring, Kirk's arm strength behind the plate, throwing to the bases, was an average of 70 miles per hour. This year, his average is 77.5. Last year, his max was 75. This year, his max is close to 82. So those are huge differences.
That's massive.
It really shows you like just the progress that he's made. It's showing up at the plate as well. Last year in the regular season, Kirk played 103 games. He hit 5 balls at 109 miles per hour or harder. This spring, he played 17 games. He's hit 5 balls at 109 plus. So he has as many balls in play this spring at 109 plus as he did all of last season. So I think that a lot of that work, those gains, that commitment is what really helped push the Blue Jays to sign Kirk to this extension, because those are the things they're going to want to see to commit these kind of, like I said, top 5 catcher dollars to Kirk and to say, hey, you're going to get the most out of your game over the next 5-6 years. And we're going to be comfortable paying you, $11.5 million in 2029 to be our starting catcher, because we believe that like you aren't going to fall off. Like you're going to continue to get better and you're going to maintain and you're going to continue to be an effective producer at the big league level.
Yeah, exactly. And look, this is not a do it all perfect player. There are going to be times where he grounds into a double play, or he goes, you know, second to third on a single that 95% of players score on. He is slow now, and he's only going to get slower. So there are flaws here, but I don't think that a player's flaws should ever stop you from seeing their strengths. And Alejandro Kirk has a lot of strengths. So I think it's a good thing for the Blue Jays to have him locked in. They still need more catching, of course, to find, you know, a better alternative than Tyler Heineman. Maybe that's developing someone. Maybe it's drafting someone. Maybe it's trading for someone. We'll see. But They do need some, you know, support. It was a really good combo for the Blue Jays to have Danny Jansen and Kirk for so many years. Now they kind of need that second pairing, but to have Kirk there is a really good thing.
Can I jump in there really quickly? Just because that's part of the consideration here, the calculation, is that the Blue Jays have nothing internally, catching-wise. Yeah. Like, it goes back to what we were talking about before. They're, like, quote-unquote catching prospects. Phil Clark is 27. Andres Sosa, also 27. And then it's just, like, minor league free agents. Christian Bethencourt and Ali Sanchez and Matt Whatley. Like, you just, there is nobody coming. Like, Jacob Sharp is probably the highest regarded prospect catcher in the organization. He's going to be 24 this year. He came over from Seattle in the Justin Turner deal. Maybe there's something there, but they just aren't developing like a good major league catcher internally. So like that makes it a rather pressing matter to keep Kirk around. And then also you just don't see really good catchers hit the open market very often. Like you're just not going to find another Kirk in free agency in the next couple of years because teams extend guys like this. You know, if you're a good catcher and you're kind of a good all-around defensive and offensive catcher like Kirk is, obviously putting the base running aside, you get extended. Like you just don't get to the open market. And it's somewhat easier to extend a catcher because, you know, for kind of ironically for how important they are in the game, they really don't get paid. Like they just don't get big salaries for one reason or another. Like Real Muto is probably the best paid catcher in the game, or like Sal Perez, and those guys are like low 20 mil. I think for all of those reasons, it made it, you know, really prudent that the Blue Jays get this deal done. The lack of alternatives if they hadn't done it.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at, you know, the AAV around 11 million, the free agent years around 12.5. Like that's kind of reliever money. Like that's
Chad Green money.
Andrew Kittredge gets that money from the Orioles. You know, it's like, who's more important to your team, Andrew Kittredge or Alejandro Kirk? Like it's not even close. It is actually kind of weird. I actually think that's probably an inefficiency that teams are not valuing catchers enough and they're not paying them enough. And, you know, good for the Blue Jays to get Kirk locked in, but
especially because there's such a scarcity of like really good talent at that position, both defensively and particularly offensively. If you get a catcher who can give you like a 95 WRC plus like Kirk has the last 2 years, like you're over the moon about that.
So what do you make of this? They have tried the ABS system in spring training this season, and it certainly could arrive in the major leagues at some point relatively soon, at which point Kirk's one of his really big values is framing. So that would disappear. That would be something that, of course, you still need a good defensive catcher to be able to handle the pitching staff and block baseballs, throw out the running game. Catching defense would still matter, but the framing aspect of it would no longer matter whatsoever. So I find that just to be an interesting wrinkle here, given how important Kirk's framing is to the team.
But I believe that when it gets to the majors, it is going to be the challenge system that we've seen in spring. I don't think baseball will ever go to full ABS, or at least not with the ABS that we have now. Like there would have to be pretty dramatic advancements made to just the quality of the system. So in a challenge world, like you're not getting every pitch ruled by ABS. So you can still steal some borderline strikes along the way. ABS will lessen the importance of it, but with teams limited to just two challenges, are they going to be challenging every pitch in the second inning, in the third inning, in the fourth inning? Or are they probably going to be saving those until later in the game? I think that there are still going to be strikes to be stolen early in a game because teams just aren't challenging at that point because the leverage doesn't make sense to do so. I also think it's a benefit having a catcher behind the plate who has such a good understanding of the strike zone, as Kirk has demonstrated repeatedly throughout spring training, who can help you get calls overturned that don't go your way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that kind of answers it, but worth considering. And end of the day, you have to play the rules that exist in front of you. I mean, you can't worry about what the CBA is going to look like in 8 years. You can't worry about what the rules are going to look like, you know, potentially 18 months, 24 months down the road. These are the rules that are in place right now. If they change, they change. But Kirk can still do a lot of things to help the Blue Jays out. That is the decision of the week presented by MLB The Show 25.
Guerrero smacks one into the gap and the Blue Jays are off to the races. Bichette getting the wave around third. He's going to come in to score as the throw's cut off. And- ties the game at one.
Well, Arden, it should pretty much be a weekly segment at this point. The Vlad Jr. contract check-in. We think that we're done with it each week, and then something surfaces.
I don't think we're done with it.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Not this week. I probably did think we were done with it last week, but clearly there is more juice to this story, and particularly that comes from some of the comments made by Blue Jays president and CEO Mark Shapiro when he was meeting with yourself and other members of the media down in Dunedin, Florida last week, and made some comments indicating confidence that the Blue Jays would be able to extend Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at some point. Now, could that be tomorrow? Could that be, you know, when he's a free agent? You know, there weren't specifics offered by Shapiro as far as when he expects that to happen, but this was notable confidence from the president of the team, especially because the typical playbook, as you and I know very well from having covered the entirety of this Toronto Blue Jays front office, is for them to simply say, you know what, we don't discuss this publicly. We're, you know, we're going to keep those discussions private behind closed doors. If there's an update that we can share, we would be happy to do so. But in the meantime, we're just going to keep that between us. And that's the playbook that a lot of teams use. It's pretty standard. So in contrast to that, it was very interesting to hear the comments from Mark Shapiro.
It was. And I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on it, because I've, ever since that happened, I've kind of been racking my brain at like what the strategic advantage is there for Shapiro coming out and saying that. Because, look, this is 10 years of Mark Shapiro now. We know that everything is said with a purpose. Everything is said with intent. He doesn't just speak off the cuff. So there's a reason why he framed it the way that he did. There's a reason why he said something that clearly is going to raise fan expectations quite a bit. And there's a reason why he did something that, just like on the face of it, doesn't appear to aid his side's leverage. I'm not as skilled of a negotiator or a bargainer as Mark Shapiro is. So, like, I'm just really curious what the game is that he's playing there, and like why he came out and said that, and how he feels that's gonna help his side's position, because I haven't been able to figure it out yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I can guess his intent, but I can look at some of the fallout from this, and maybe that guides us back to what his goals might have been. I don't know. But I think as a consequence of this, the pressure shifts a little bit from the Blue Jays to Vlad Guerrero Jr. I think there's a little bit more of, hey, the Blue Jays are repeating and indicating that they're willing to play ball here and that they're very much open to this. So I think that that's perhaps one part of it. I think it sort of depressurizes things for the Blue Jays a little bit. Instead of having this, oh my goodness, it has to happen now, there's this looming moment, it sort of spreads that pressure over the course of the season, where Shapiro's saying at some point. So I see that pressure shifting away from these few days to maybe it's the All-Star break, maybe it's October, or, you know, not October, but November, December. So that could be one you know, consequence of this. It's all part of a dance that's happening here. I think that the Blue Jays and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., you know, I've had people who have, you know, who are not connected to this process, look at this from afar, look at this as outsiders, but who are people in the industry, and say they're negotiating. You know, they might not be sitting down and exchanging numbers, but they're still negotiating. They're still engaged with one another. Now, does that lead to a meaningful negotiation where numbers are exchanged? Does that lead to a deal? We don't know about that. But I do see a kind of dance happening here. And Mark Shapiro, I don't know what his intention was, but it was, the dance kind of continued there. It wasn't shut down. And so part of the subtext that I'm seeing here is the Blue Jays are saying to Vlad Jr., hey, if you come back to us with a slightly lowered ask, we might be able to get something done. I'm reading that subtext. Now, does Vlad Jr. actually take that and say, okay, great, I want to lower my offer, I'm thrilled to do that? I don't think so. But similarly, Vlad Jr. has kind of indicated to the Blue Jays, if you guys boost your offer, I'll talk. So I kind of see both sides kind of circling this and saying, if you're willing to move, I'm still where I am. And they're both seemingly, to me, waiting for the other side to move. Now, I don't know if it's going to happen, but that's how I see this dance unfolding.
Right. And so as far as we understand it, Vlad is seeking $500 million net present value, and the Blue Jays have come in at a height of $450 million net present value.
Yes, that's my understanding.
Which has already multiple times exceeded their prior walkaways. And look, if you ran those numbers by Mark Shapiro, he would tell you that's an oversimplification based upon only part of the information. Okay, that's the only information we have. So let's work with that.
And that's always true as media members, right? Like, I'm a podcaster. Yeah. Of course the information is incomplete. Of course I'm making assumptions. I am not inside at the time. I mean, that should be, hopefully our listeners know that's always the case. We never have the full information. We're media members. I'm a writer. Like, I'm not, of course, at best, I have, you know, 70% of the information at best. More often, it's way less than that.
Mark, give us a call and explain all the details, all the information, share all the details.
Exactly.
Which, you know, many of which we would not even really understand, like, the nuances of, because neither of us has ever negotiated a $500 million contract.
To be fair, most major league GMs haven't either. So,
no, that's a good point. Yeah. And most, including the Blue Jays, have not completed one. So there's that point too. So anyway, 450 to 500. We kind of talked about how last time when we talked about this 45 minutes ago was that there's a $475 million midpoint that is kind of natural there, where both sides save face. And neither side looks like, because like, if the Blue Jays go up to 500, then they caved. And if Vlad comes down to 450, well, then he bluffed. What you're suggesting is that the Jays are messaging publicly, and Vlad is maybe back channeling, not necessarily messaging publicly right now, that if you go first to 475, we will come to the table and talk about that. Like, what you're saying is neither side wants to be the one that moves first, but they are messaging to the opposite side, if you move first, we'll come meet you there.
That's my read on the situation. Yeah, I could be wrong, but that's my read. I think that neither side clearly is shutting this down entirely, right? There's at least a sliver, maybe it's a small sliver, but there is at least a sliver of a possibility on both sides. But I also don't see either side leaping and saying, oh my goodness, we made such a mistake back in February. I've totally reevaluated things. My position was completely off. I want to meet you all the way and I want to cover that ground completely. You know, here's 500 net present value, or I've lowered my ask. I actually think that, you know, I'm not as good as I thought I was. Spring training really humbled me. You know, that one AB against the Phillies, I have to lower my ask to 450.
My ground ball rate is really concerning.
Yeah. No, so this is my read, is that there is and I'm very fascinated. I think that there's some chance that these sides get to the point that they're sitting down and having a discussion. But I really think that the question of who moves first, who picks up the phone and says, yeah, we'd really like to have this serious conversation, that's my question. I honestly don't know. I actually don't think that anyone knows who would move first. And I think that's the standoff that's happening now. I could be wrong, but that's my read on things.
No, and this entire process at all junctures from both sides has been conflated in ego and pridefulness. But is that not like the ultimate in ego and pridefulness getting in the way of a relationship, of a deal, of a partnership getting done?
Yeah, I think that you could read it that way, or you could say that in negotiation strategy, which, as you said before, I am no means an expert in, but there is something to be said about who goes first. I mean, there is leverage to be gained or lost by moving first.
If you're meeting in the middle anyway, what's the matter?
Well, I don't know that either side would meet in the middle, though.
Right.
I don't know that 475 is that actual number.
You're saying the Jays want 470 and Vlad wants 480.
I think the Jays want 450 and Vlad wants 500. I think they're, okay. I don't know. I don't know. And look, this is where the wrinkle of Mark Shapiro saying that he has some confidence here, or optimism. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but indicating some confidence here. I mean, that seems to suggest that there could be room to move up for the Blue Jays, but I don't know. Until that action happens, until there is a text message or a email indicated to Vlad Guerrero Jr.'s agents, you know, it's kind of a lot of talk. And so really with all this stuff, it's actions, it's not words, it's what actually happens. And, you know, that's where these next few days have some pretty high stakes for these talks.
The Jays need 474 and Vlad needs 476. And neither will budge, and off to free agency it goes. I think that, like, the ultimately all along, and I still think this is the most likely outcome, is that these two sides need a third party to just definitively establish what the value is. And that third party is likely to be the open market. It's a very dangerous game to play for both sides. Dangerous for Vlad because now he has to go out over 162 and stay healthy and produce and not have any other external factors outside of his control impact next year's market. Dangerous for the Blue Jays because now you introduce like six other teams, five other teams who, you know, however, it's really a pretty select group that can actually afford a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. contract. So, but you are now opening up competition from other organizations that could be willing to go to places that you are not at all comfortable going to. And ultimately, I think Vlad is going to sign where he gets the most money, or where he gets the money that he feels he is worth. So there's danger on both sides to go to the market, but I do think that's how this ultimately ends, is the Blue Jays let him go to market and they try to compete for him there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a chance for someone to budge. If someone budges in the next few days, then anything could happen. If no one budges, then I think, yeah, open market. And I don't think there's a guarantee at all that Vlad Jr. would take his biggest, best offer back to the Blue Jays. Because if the Red Sox offer 560 on day three of the winter meetings, he might just take it. You know, I don't think they necessarily circle back and say, hey, guys, just a courtesy here after all these great negotiations we've had that led absolutely nowhere. Like, I don't know.
No, it's possible that John Henry flies him out to a Liverpool game and wines and dines him. And, you know, Craig Breslow convinces him about how good the system is and how the Blue Jays farm system just isn't nearly as good as they are. And David Ortiz is like, oh, hey, trust me, man. Like, you're going to love it in Boston. They're going to take such good
Pedro
care of
Martinez.
You. Right. And they're saying, oh, you'll go into the Hall of Fame wearing a Red Sox hat. And yeah, you look at all these other Dominican guys who have played there and, you know, done great and been embraced. And yeah, it's totally possible that he says, oh, hey, you're all making some really good points. And I've got 565 million other reasons why I think that your argument is convincing, and leaves Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins on red as he, e-signs the DocuSign.
Yeah, his text message history with Ross Atkins just all blue on one side. As he's obsessed with Liverpool. He's like a huge soccer fan at this point. Yeah, who knows where this thing could go? Obviously, not trying to make light of it. It's a huge moment for the Blue Jays here.
What else can you do at this point, man?
Well,
like,
it's a new
chapter of this thing.
Yeah,
at some point,
truly.
I'm just going to start joking around about it because it is so absurd.
Yeah, kind of is. All right, well, let's leave that there. We'll see. There could be huge news, or it could just be an ongoing story of the season. We'll see. We'll obviously keep talking about it. We have to step away shortly here on At the Letters. But before we do that, Arden, I want to check in on Max Scherzer and his health. You were there, as you mentioned before, in Fort Myers, lovely Fort Myers, Florida, to hear from Max Scherzer and get a sense of where he's at with his thumb and his comfort level during and after, I guess more importantly, the days that he pitches. What is your read on Scherzer?
My read is that this is something that we're going to be talking about all year long, just like we're going to be talking about Vlad's contract situation all year long. And like, that's from Max. Like, he, since 2023, he's been dealing with this, right? Like, the back issue was a whole separate thing, but like the thumb thing, the nerve thing, that's something that he's been searching for answers on with like hand specialists and various doctors for some time. And like, in his words, he does not have the answers, but his entire arm health is like predicated on his thumb. It's wild. There's inflammation between the CMC and MCP joints in his thumb, which is just like basically between the joint closest to your wrist and then the one closest to your fingertip. And because of the way that he grips the ball and the amount of pressure that he puts on it to get the action that he needs to be effective, it just causes inflammation to build up around 60, 65, 70, 80 pitches. And he has to manage that very carefully in between outings, because if the inflammation gets too bad, then it develops into a nerve issue. And then a nerve issue can very easily move up his arm and get into his elbow and his shoulder and cause like a whole host of problems. So like he's already been making adjustments to his throwing program and in his recovery, treatment, various like ways of managing this throughout the season to no avail. And I think ultimately this is just something that he and the Blue Jays are going to have to be really cautious with throughout the year, with building in extra rest, maybe not letting him throw that 105th pitch or go out for another inning, even though he's like, you know, giving John Schneider a murderous stare to get him to go out back on the mound. Like, I think the Blue Jays are just going to have to be very prudent in staying on top of this thing, because evidently when it gets worse, it snowballs and it gets really, really bad.
Well, and you've seen that too around spring training with some of the nerve related injuries. Parker Meadows, just no timeline for him. That's a huge issue for the Tigers. Shane McClanahan, scary moment for him the other day. Turns out it was a nerve issue for him, so they have to let that nerve calm down. You don't want to let it get to that point, because at that point you're talking multi-week absences. Far better if you're the Toronto Blue Jays to manage this to the extent that you can. Right now, having a week between outings, that's great. That's where you want it to be. And then ideally, yeah, you can find some spots where you're not pushing him too hard. But end of the day, this is a very demanding physical task that is going to put stress on that thumb. And so we'll see how it plays out. I think it's a huge variable for the Blue Jays this year. Should be interesting, along with everything else, as we ramp up for opening day here.
Yeah, and Max is frustrated by it, because like he knows he can still pitch at this level. And clearly when he's out on the mound, and like he feels fine on the mound, by the way, once he kind of gets loosened up and, you know, everything gets warm, he feels fine and he's able to execute. And clearly he's still able to miss a ton of bats in the zone and rack up strikeouts and turn left when hitters are thinking he's going to turn right. Like, he's clearly still very effective at the highest level. It's the next day when as he's recovering, when things don't bounce back well and the issues crop up, and now all of a sudden he's going to miss his next start. So I think that is infuriating to him, that, you know, he can still compete at this level close to the age of 41 as one of the better pitchers in the game, and yet there's just this very small area in his thumb that is really impacting his entire arm health. You can imagine for a competitor like Max, and for somebody who's as intense and serious about their craft as he is, that is something that has been very troublesome for him over the last couple of years.
That's right. Well, we will leave it there for this week. Look for Arden on the Sportsnet broadcasts, and look for our work as well at sportsnet.ca as the season ramps up. We actually have a ton of stuff planned, articles, some features, some roundtables. So look for that at sportsnet.ca. And thank you so much for listening and sticking with us here as a new season begins for the Toronto Blue Jays. And we'll continue discussing it, of course, every step of the way here on At the Letters, presented by MLB The Show 25. Thank you as well to our producer, Christian Ryan. And for Arden Swelling, I'm Ben Nicholson-Smith. Thank you so much for listening.